I've been thinking something has been on my mind for a while. These darn braggarts, and I got this harebrained idea. You remember back when we were doing, we did a whole big thing about caramelizing honey. And I know a couple of you said something that, I think it was Jeff said something about he's doing it in a crock pot. I think Chris mentioned, pressure cooker thing. And so I probably did about now 15 pounds of honey, just trying different things in the pressure cooker. Well, I was really, I wanted more control, and I thought, that crock pot thing is probably the way to go. And so I emailed Jeff today. Jeff knows all about this. So I emailed Jeff. I said, Jeff, what setting do you use on your crock pot when you're caramelizing honey? So he wrote me back. So I'm on my way to Target to get a small little cheap crock pot, like a $12 crock pot. So I get there, and there's actually two of them sitting on the shelf. One of them's red, and the other one's black. And I thought, God damn, I wanted to be able to see the honey in the bottom of the crock pot. Well, sitting right next to it is this. Now, these are like 2-quart crock pots. These are small enough. I mean, I don't even think I could fix a meal in them big enough for me. I know Chris wouldn't put up with it. So this one sitting next to it is like 2.5 quarts, but it's like $30. It's white. Okay. Versus the red one and the black one. So guess which one JD came home with? The $30 one. just because I wanted to be able to see the honey change colors. So my little will start out to be like a $12 crock pot turned into a three. It just thing's fancy too, guys. It's got this lid that locks down on top. I guess you could take the darn thing, put it in a car, put it in a trunk, and it won't spill because the lid kind of locks down on this thing. So but anyway, so that's my crock pot story for the day.
when you were given the little teaser on that, I was worried that you had a boil over or something. So I guess splurging on a little bit more of a fancy crock pot, that's not too bad.
I'll give you
a similar story. I get online to order a grain bill. For an idea that I've got, and I'm thinking this is, going to be 25, 30 bucks, a few pounds of grain, a couple ounces of hops, and I'm good to go. Maybe a packet of yeast, 30 bucks at the most. And then I started thinking, I'm going to try that Y-East nutrient to get some of that. And then I thought, I'm going to need another bag or two, a mesh bag. So I threw a couple of those in, and oh yeah, I need a new aeration stone, and I better pick up another foam stopper and flask because I'm going to have to do a starter on this. And so by the time it's like $250 by the time I'm finished for what was going to be a $30 order, When I looked at the cart, I went to the checkout cart and I looked at it and I looked at the total and I was like, I think I'm going to wait a while.
Well, we all know what a tightwad you are, too.
I don't like spending money.
Yeah. Hey, welcome to the Mead House. We got a pretty good show for you tonight. Ryan is out of town, so he won't be with us tonight, but Aaron Martin's in the house, Mississippi Chris Spencer. Now, he may or may not be here for the duration of the show. And Jeff Schaus is also in the house. My name is Jay, the Mead House, themeadhouse.com. The replays, they're all over the place. Look on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, you name it. They're also, of course, featured right here at home themeathouse.com. And hey, if you want to call the show, 818-921-4680. Happy to take your call. Jeff, I want to throw a shout out real quick before I throw it over to you. Tony, I'm going to butcher your last name. Fair warning. Okay. Tony Cormier. You're just going to have to correct me, I guess, on the Facebook deal there, Tony, but I got this message just a little bit, probably 10 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago. Tony's been, he's an avid listener, and he's heard me mention my Kahlua a couple of times on the show. Apparently, Tony's family has been making homemade Kahlua since the Prohibition days. Nice. And he wants to compare recipes, so I'm looking forward to that. Chris, he's really looking forward to your discussion on the pectic enzyme and the Camden tablets and all of that. And of course, Jeff's going to talk to us about mouthfeel, what all that means to us and everything. So, thanks for listening, Tony. Enjoy the show, my friend. I know he's listening live tonight. Jeff, what did you find on Facebook today?
Well, I got a couple shout outs. These are both from the meat group. One of them, Kellen Williams has a couple experiments in the vein of Heart of Darkness that I thought I'd throw a shout out to, just because I know Mississippi's been experimenting with some stuff similar to that. Looks like he had about 4.5 pounds per gallon of honey as a start, and then he did. It looks like he has one experiment that he added fruit in primary, and then another one where he added the fruit in secondary, kind of to see which one he prefers. So yeah, interesting stuff, and thought I'd throw a shout out to him. And then another name I'm going to butcher, Michael Rigi on Mead, had a photo of a bottle of a 40-year-old Mead in an earthenware jar. It's a Polish Mead. The name of it, part in English, part in Polish, is a delicious Polish Mead, Mielniak Mead. Miod Pitney. Really interesting looking stuff. And I know the Polish actually have a fairly well established history of mead, to the point that a lot of their styles or recipes are considered historical when it comes to BJCP judging. So that I thought actually might even be an interesting topic for us to kind of branch briefly into some of the historical types of mead out there. Yeah, this it looks like this stuff is very, very sweet, a big chunk of it is made with raspberry juice. The Mielniak indicates that from being derivative of their word for raspberries.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, that was just a very cool 40-year-old bottle of mead. It was definitely something that piqued my interest. They're like, oh, hello.
Yeah, cool. You know, I'd be, all of my research and everything that I was doing on mead before I, you know, started in on all this stuff. I mean, it all basically comes from the European countries. And I was surprised how many European countries, actually even still get into the mead making. It's like a big thing over there. So, and a lot of the old, recipes, of course. What's the name of that book? Went right out, right off the top of my freaking head here. What's the name of that book? It's got that that old recipe in it.
Dilbies or something like that.
Guys.
Sir
somebody.
Some's closet or something.
Yeah. Anyway, it's got some really old recipes, European stuff. So I would be interested in exploring that on a few shows too. Because Ryan's not here tonight, we had our little list of things we wanted to talk about. We're not going to do it in the order that we started out. So we're actually going to start out with Jeff. You know, Jeff, my mead making here, you know, I make stuff. It tastes good, but there's always something missing. And I couldn't put my finger on it until I started tasting other people's meads. And I think it has everything to do with mouthfeel. And I've been thinking about that for a while. And so when I drink my commercially made wines that I buy or the beers that I buy, I'm trying to tune into that. Just exactly, you know, what is this mouthfeel? What does it mean? What am I tasting? What does it feel like? That kind of thing. And I thought, you know, maybe we should spend some time talking about mouthfeel and how to introduce. Well, first of all, let's talk about exactly what it is. What is this mouthfeel? How do we find it when we take a sip? What are we looking for? And then secondly, how do we replicate that? How do we introduce that into our meat? Because like I say, some of the stuff that I make, it's water. It tastes good, but it's like drinking water.
Sure. Well, and I think you're right. The whole idea of mouthfeel is it's not something we focus on immediately, but it can be that extra little 10% that really makes the difference between a good mead and a really great mead. When we talk about mouthfeel, usually there's actually a couple terms we talk about. We talk about mouthfeel or we talk about body. They're very similar concepts, usually in terms of judging or in terms of like wine tasting. They tend to get lumped together because they're really similar. When we talk about body, we're talking about basically your perception of like the weight of the liquid or the viscosity of the liquid, how heavy the liquid feels, if you'll pardon the generalization there. Whereas mouthfeel is, it's kind of the touch sensations of your perception. You could get a feeling of smoothness, of creaminess, or of a little bit of an acid bite, a tannic pucker. It's the way that your touch nerves in your mouth kind of respond to it, as opposed to your taste buds or your nose inhaling the sense of liquid in your mouth. And it is important. It's actually highly studied in not only wine and beer, but in food in general. That perception of how it feels. Our mouths are actually just like chock-a-block full of these little nerve endings. So it makes a level of sense. And really, when we're talking about mouthfeel, we're talking about essentially just having something that's pleasant to drink. Depending on the type of brew you're going for, you're looking for something that feels, you know, like rounded or balanced. It might have a subtle, smooth mouthfeel. It might feel really rich and round. There's different possibilities there, but if what you want to avoid are things like you mentioned that they're watery, they're thin, they might be harsh or aggressive, they might be rough, too syrupy or too thick and viscous can be a bad thing too. And really, when it comes to mouthfeel, what we're looking for, I've harped on this again and again, is good balance. So when you talk about something that feels really watery and thin, generally that can be a little bit too much on the acid side. Whereas if it's lower in the acid, that can make something that feels like kind of flat or flabby, just not very springy. The fine line between the two is kind of where you want to be with that. In the case of having something that's really acidic, a little bit extra residual sugar, even something small like 0.5%, can actually give you a nice little bump. And there's a lot of different ways to accomplish that. I mean, for one, you could always back sweeten. When it comes to beer, that's an easy way to take it. Very small amounts at a time can give you a little bit more feel to it. Mississippi has mentioned a time or two before that adding like half a banana, an overripe banana, in primary can give you some extra mouthfeel. I think part of that actually comes down to,
oops, You okay there?
Yeah, my microphone fell out here. Part of that comes down to sugars that are harder for the yeast to digest. Something that's really common for a lot of these higher body applications are what they refer to as polysaccharides. It's basically like a long chain of sugar molecules. You can get those from a number of different sources. You find those in fruit, especially the skins. That's why red wines especially are known for aging on grape skins. There are a number of different yeasts that just make those as part of their byproducts. So that's kind of like the same vein as those fruity esters that we like to talk about.
Yeah.
You can get those also just from the breakdown of yeast cells too. And so like, when we were talking about D47 and aging on the leaves, that's kind of the same idea. You want those, decaying yeast cells to create some of those polysaccharides that, or protein chains, I should say, in this case, that contribute to that feel or that flavor. Another thing that really strongly contributes to mouthfeel is tannin levels. And, tannins are where you get that harsh pucker if it's a little too hard. Without it can feel a little bit one-dimensional and a little bit boring. So again, you know, a lot of these dimensions here we're talking about balancing, getting just a little bit extra, just a little bit more or less to really dial in the perfect like flavor and experience, not just flavor, but also the qualitative like fun of drinking it, if you will.
Yeah. How do you, you mentioned the banana thing, and I've heard Chris talk about that, but, how do you introduce, this isn't something where are we looking to change the flavor here, or I don't think I'm looking to change the flavor. I want something that, like you were explaining, something that tastes right in my mouth. It's not watery and loose and you know.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of different approaches to this, of course. Obviously you can tinker with the acid levels by, you know, doing an acid blend or specific acids like malic or tartaric acid.
That's kind of dangerous, isn't it?
It's chancy. Everything is chancy, though, with dialing this in. That's why you want to do it just a little at a time. You could add residual sugars, like I was talking about before. You can also explore different yeast strains, because some yeasts are more attenuative than others, and they'll leave more of that residual sugar, different, like, protein chains and polysaccharides and stuff afterwards. So part of that is going to be just coming from yeast character, different other things you can kind of tinker with towards the end. You know, we can talk about oak aging or aging on vanilla or cocoa nibs, things like that. Those are all going to give some level of tannin. Oak being, of course, the really predominant one there.
What about using some kind of a wine tannin? I mean, you go to Midwest Supply and Northern Brewer and More Beer, More Wine. All these places out there, you can actually buy all, I mean, there's a whole realm of different kinds of tannins out there. Now, granted, this is more for the wine industry, but we've adapted so much from the wine industry into mead making. So why not? But they make white wine tannins and red wine tannins. Could you use those, as well? Sure.
When my first couple of batches, I actually had just a powdered oak tannin that I used for my tannin levels. It works okay. It can be a little bit one dimensional. You don't get all of that nice oak character that you get from aging on oak, but it works. You can get tannins out of it.
And some of the best tannin can come from black tea. Easy black to control. Tea, yeah. Yeah.
Now that's the we just went through this, Chris. It's not the flavored stuff. It's a straight black tea.
Yeah, just straight black tea. Something like an Irish breakfast tea or something.
Yeah.
real good way to get tannin in without overdoing it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
another thing you could do to add more of the body, and in this case we're talking more about like kind of a thickness or a perceptual sweetness. A number of wine producers use gums, like gum arabic, to give it a little bit extra boost in that regard. It doesn't actually change the flavor or boost a lot of the sweetness of it, but it adds a little bit to the viscosity or the thickness of the wine and helps it that way. I haven't really seen that on the home winemaking, home meat-making market, but I know it's been mentioned as a common technique for kind of bumping that with the industry as a whole.
Don't they use glycerin also?
I believe so.
Yeah, I've seen that mentioned on a couple of wine sites that I visit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think glycerin is like the major component in what they call wine conditioners and things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems like that's the biggest thing that I struggle with. When I'm making, just a straight up honey and water mead, the final product, although it tastes good, it's just got this thin, watery, it doesn't leave you with any kind of anything, not something that you want to get excited about. So, just looking for ways to try to improve that feel in your mouth that makes you want to take another sip or pour another glass. That's something that we really haven't gone into any kind of detail about on the show yet. Right. It's probably one of the most important. Last week we talked about the entering into competition. And so this is going to be, at least I would assume, this is going to be an extremely important aspect of your mead when a judge takes that first sip, right?
It's not going to be an extremely important part. It is a part of the whole components you're judged on. But it is a fact. And it contributes more than you would think to the overall experience of it, which is also something you're judged on. In the case of a kind of a thinner, waterier wine, like I mentioned before, I'm sorry, a thinner, waterier mead, that could be indicative of something a little bit more acidic. Another thing we should talk about, and I don't think we've talked about it very much, is the difference between like pH and total acidity. Because there are also kits that you can buy in your home wine store that measure total acidity, and something that is higher in acid content, but maybe not perceptually so, would be more indicative with that kind of a test than with pH, or it's something just like taste testing it. It might be a case where you're getting more acid than you realize, and that's kind of throwing off that flavor or that taste, and maybe a little bit of residual sugar or a balance with some tannins would do it good. I've said more than once that generally when I do a traditional or something with a really light flavor to it, I like to use oak just as a, not to get the oaky flavor so much as just to get some tannins into it, that are really smooth and subtle. Generally don't taste that oak character in it, but it makes a big difference in terms of the mouthfeel. It kind of helps give it that little extra something. So that's always been a favorite approach to mine.
Yeah.
And Jeff, you might also mention a little bit about ABV. That can greatly affect the body, and especially, and it doesn't always work the same way with different beverages either.
That's true.
Like for instance, in a malt based beverage, more alcohol tends to make it more watery to some extent, whereas in most meads, a higher ABV is going to add more body to it.
And well, to some extent, yes, and to some extent, no. I mean, it also depends on some of the qualities you get from fermentation, because the fusel alcohols you can get from a hot ferment can add to that sense of dryness, or that harsh kind of sting that comes with being really acidic.
Hello?
Really
camp.
Hang on, Ryan. Go ahead, Jeff.
So higher or lower alcohol content can affect that as well. Another thing, especially in the beer world, having more alcohol in it tends to make it feel drier, tends to make it sting a little bit more. So you tend to go for, with your beers looking for more body, you tend to go for either a malt like a Munich malt that has less enzyme activity and is therefore like less utilized by the yeast. Go for a yeast that will digest less of the available like malts and sugars and things like that that way, so that you leave a little bit more behind.
Yeah.
And again, that just comes back to yeast character and things like that too.
Interesting. Ryan, I just got a text from Ryan. Apparently he felt completely ignored, probably sitting by himself in a hotel room, just bored to death, and he sent me a text. Says, please bring me. How are you doing, Ryan?
I am doing wonderful, coming at you live from West Des Moines, Iowa. And you are right. I am in the third floor of a Marriott, and thought, hey, I want to talk to my friends.
Bored to death. Nothing better.
Do they have a wild party nightlife there in Des Moines?
Well, it's 8:28, and I'm in the hotel room talking to you, Chris.
Oh, that's pretty boring, man.
Yeah, he's bored to death.
Yeah. Well,
you know, Jeff, I can see this. We could probably do a few more segments on talking about this stuff and really kind of dialing in here a little bit. But I want to kind of move into Mississippi, because I know he's probably pressed for time. How are you doing for time, Chris?
I'm doing good right now.
Okay. You know, so the other thing about now Chris is going to do this segment because he's like the Melomel guy of the house. Okay, I mean, anything you ever want to know about Melomel, Mississippi, Chris Spencer is the guy to talk to here at the Mead House. So I thought, you know, and I've talked about some of this stuff with Chris too. Like you said on another show, he's sometimes my go-to guy when I got some questions. Chris, you know, Melomels, we're talking fruit here. And, yep. You know, as you well know, you know, all of this fruit requires some maintenance. Okay. You just can't dump, you know, a bunch of, cut up peaches into a bucket, add some honey and some water, and expect this miracle peach mead to come you know, out in, you know, a couple of months. So there is some preparation that needs to happen to the fruit first to avoid some troubles down the line. So let's talk about that for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got to know, obviously, what kind of mead you're going to make. If you're going wine style, if you're going sack mead, or you doing something more along the lines of a hydromel. So once you've got this figured out, now you make me out to be the expert on melomels, and I am by no means. I certainly still do my fair share of experimentation, but I have had quite a bit of success in it also. You know, how do you want to approach your getting your fruit into your mead? And there's several ways to do this. You got fruit juices, you've got fruit concentrates, you've got frozen fruit, fruit that you've grown your own, or picked fresh. There's lots of ways to do this. Is fresh fruit better? Yeah, most of the time. But that does not mean that you can't make some really good melomels from concentrates and juices. And there's plenty of people out there that are going to tell you that you can't. I know you can because I've done it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a lot of things to consider when you're dealing with fruit, but what we're going to focus on right now is using whole fruit. We're going to either frozen or fresh picked, either one. That's what I want to focus on because that's most people's best option. And you have the most selection to buy from at the supermarket or farmer's market or a pick your own. So generally, I used to throw fruit into a bucket and not worry about it. And if you want to do that, you certainly can. And I never had a problem with that. But I then later on, I discovered something that made a huge difference in the melomels that I was making, and it was called lalazine. Now, mm-hmm. most of you are familiar with pectic enzyme, and basically it breaks down the pectins. It helps in the clearing of your melomel, and it does help to extract some of the juices and flavors. However, the lalazine, and it's a Lalamond product, contains quite a few different enzymes. And so what we're doing is we're attacking lots of different aspects here, lots of different starches, different sugars, and even to the extent of some of the, like the polyphenol content, which is going to translate into more tannin extraction, more color extraction. And these are all things that are present in the fruit. If you eat a piece of fruit by itself, you're getting all those things as you chew it. So if you want that to translate into your mead, you're going to have to extract it from the fruit. And this lalazine product helps to do that. However, it does need some time to work, and generally 4 or 5 days will really get pretty much everything you want out of the fruit. So this sort of presented a problem. How do you let fruit sit for 4 or 5 days without it starts to ferment spontaneously? So basically what I started doing is getting a bucket with a sealable lid and an airlock. And it's important to have an airlock because even though we're going to sulfite this fruit, it could possibly still start fermenting. And if you don't have an airlock on there, your bucket's going to explode. Mm-hmm. So what I like to do is to take my fresh fruit, regardless of what it is, whether it's berries, peaches, or whatever, I like to mash it up in the bucket. Try not to crack the seeds or anything because you don't want to extract things from the seeds, but just something that you would mash similar to mashing it with your hand. Add just a little bit of water, just enough to dissolve your sulfites, Camden tablet or whatever, whether you're using powder or the tablets. Stir that sulfite into that fruit thoroughly along with your lalazine. Put the lid on and airlock it. The sulfites should prevent any kind of fermentation, and the lalazine will sit there for 4 or 5 days. And at the end of 4 or 5 days, your fruit is going to be literally just almost all juice. And it's very easy to separate out if you want to at that point. But what I normally do is drain off the juice, mix up my must, and that gives me a very accurate starting gravity. If you put whole fruit in that hasn't gone through this process, your starting gravity is going to change as that fruit begins to break down and release its juices. And more often than not, your starting gravity is actually going to go down, because even though the juice has sugar in it, it doesn't have enough sugar in it to raise the gravity. It's got more water, so it dilutes it. So what you thought was a starting gravity of 1120, by the time you put the fruit in, may end up being 1100, 1105, or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah, I never thought of that. Yeah.
So if you go through this process, pour the juice in, mix up your must, then you can pull the pulp out, and you can go ahead and put the pulp in as well once you get your starting gravity. Mm-hmm. And that's what I started doing with all my fruit. Yes, it's a little more messy. In fact, it's really messy. When I was doing this heart murmur project here and all this testing, it looked like somebody was murdered in my kitchen. If you want to make a mess, go get some red raspberries and do this, and it looks like something was slaughtered in your kitchen.
Well, yeah. But, what were you using to mash the raspberries? A 4x4 or something?
Yeah, I keep a 2x4 that I use to mash berries and fruit. Yeah, it works fine. Well, I'm qualifying it anyway. What difference?
Chris, when you use the Lalozyme, do you notice any difference, or have you ever tried freezing the fruit first versus just using it totally fresh?
Well, I normally do freeze it. I don't really know that if it's necessary, because number one, I'm crushing it, and number two, the Lalozyme does such a good job that I really don't think there's anything to gain from freezing it, other than maybe the fact that I've heard that freezing can actually kill some wild yeast. So maybe there's a benefit there, but I sulfide it anyway. Just remember, though, when you get ready to use this after your 4 or 5 days, you're going to have to take that lid off and cover it with a cloth for 24 hours. And you need to stir it occasionally during that 24-hour period to get that sulfite to come out. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to ferment it.
Yeah.
So don't forget that step as well.
When I was working on that, I still have that peach thing going here that's just kind of kicking back and taking its sweet time. But this is one of the projects I contacted Chris on with this Lalozyme thing. Really kind of unsure, because I've never used it before, but he's absolutely right. When he talked about breaking down the fruit, I mean, I had, I don't remember what it was, 25 or 27 pounds of peaches in this 5-gallon bucket, and I added this I believe it's called Lalozyme EX, Chris?
You used two different ones. You used the EX and the C-Max.
Yeah. And let me tell you, after 4 days, the fruit was reduced to nothingness. I mean, it was just a pile of pulp. I mean, just liquid, almost like you put it in a blender on a low speed and then dumped it back in the bucket. I mean, it was just amazing how it just destroyed the fruit. So.
Yeah, it really does. It gets everything out. But like I said, use your juice from it. Strain that into your must. Get everything mixed up. Get an accurate gravity. But then once you've got that, go ahead and put your skins and pulp and whatever's left in your bucket. Go ahead and put that in your must as well, because there's not enough left there to change the gravity significantly. So not only have you extracted everything the fruit has to offer, but you've also got a more accurate starting gravity. You get more color, more tannin, more flavor, more everything from it, and all the sugar contribution.
I was just going to say, when we were talking to Jeff about the mouthfeel, tannins, that kind of thing, there's an advantage to leaving the skins in. I think he mentioned the, the wine, red wines sitting on the grape skins for, during aging period. So,
sure. And yeah. That's something else we need to do in the upcoming shows. Maybe after our 2-week break, we need to spend some time on piments. There are we are lacking in the commercial world. We are lacking really, really good piments of any kind of quantity. Every now and then you run up on a good one. Sergio had a good one over at Malavino, and I've had one other that was really good, but that's something we need to spend some time on is piments.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a couple of those going.
Do you?
What were you using?
Well, we talked about this after the show once. I've got a red blend, which is made up of Zinfandel and Pinot Noir juice. And then I use the Trader Joe's Mesquite Honey. Because I think from what I've heard from you, JD, that's going to play nicely against that that Zinfandel juice.
Yeah, it could. It could very well, yeah.
Well, if it's not, you got a case coming your way.
This is JD's fault.
I'm thinking about something like either a Gewürztraminer or a Riesling juice with something like my sourwood honey that has a certain spicy, it's got a spiciness to it, which would just go perfect with the Riesling or the Gewürztraminer.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's even like a Semillon or something.
That second one I've got going is a Gewürztraminer, Sauvignon Blanc, and a Chenin Blanc with juices. With a white clover honey.
Wow, that sounds good too.
And that's got a certain spiciness too.
It's got the way I like to describe this white clover honey is it's got a cinnamon spice to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good white clover honey is very underestimated by mead makers. Because when you hear clover, you automatically think generic, but good white clover honey is makes an excellent mead.
I think we sufficiently covered the Melomel handling of fruit and the Camden and all of that. Good information there. I'm sure that if we dialed down, there's probably a little bit more we could spend on it, but Chris, checking your time. Are you still good?
I'm good for another 15 or so. I'll hang around.
Okay. Well, I skipped right past what we were drinking because I wanted to get into this thing because I didn't want to bust into your time and have you hustle through your segment, but. Wanted to get into the what we're drinking. I'll start it off this time. Guys, I'm drinking a Samuel Smith Imperial Stout because I've got this stout thing on my mind with the caramelized honey. So I'm thinking Braggot Stout type of thing here. So, but this Imperial Stout, this is outstanding. This is really good. Samuel Smith, this is a British import. Imperial Stout and quite different than the Irish stout like Guinness. This is a little more it's got a little bit more hoppiness to it than the Irish stouts that I've had. This isn't there's no real sweet component in here like I've had out of the Guinness or some of these other Irish stouts. But I'm really digging this. This has got a really dark roasted coffee, deep roasted coffee. This is something that I think Mississippi might even enjoy. But with that, let's toss it over to Aaron. Did you manage to pop a top on anything tonight, Aaron?
I did, actually, polishing off the last of a bottle from this past weekend. This is that meadery that I've recently discovered out of Chicago, Wild Blossom Meadery and Winery. And this is a Cran Nectar, it's called. It's actually 80% honey wine and 20% cranberry wine. And this has got to be one of the most unique melomels that I've had for a couple of reasons. I think number one, I just haven't, I don't know that I've had any other cranberry melomels. I just have to say, I mean, this, it's just a very intense cranberry flavor, like cranberry sauce that you would have with your, you know, your Thanksgiving turkey. So it's real tart, but then it's also pretty high on the sweetness level, which really balances it out very nicely. And I think from some of the other melomels that I've had from this meadery, this is probably my favorite one. It's weighing in at 12% ABV, and just really, really enjoying this one.
Wow. You know, I make homemade cranberry sauce at Thanksgiving, and I cut up an orange. I thinly slice an orange, peel and all, and chuck that into my cranberries as they're cooking. And when it comes out, it's got this nice tangy orange flavor. That sounds like a plan that we can throw on the brew list as well, too. So
there you go. I, you know, tasting this now, thinking of some orange flavor in there would be perfect in this too.
Jeff, what did you pour tonight?
Well, I had one of my favorite Bock, the Eyinger Celebrator. It's a Doppelbock. It's an authentic German Bock. Really dark, malty flavor. Just a little touch of hops. Like I said, it's one of my wife and I's favorite Bock styles. And really delicious. It's already gone. So I have to put myself on mute, sneak into the kitchen, and pour myself something else here shortly.
Jeff, you and I must have some sort of connection with the Bock, because it seems like every time that I start thinking about them, you're either thinking the same thing or you're drinking one.
Well, yeah, I keep them in the house to keep the wife happy. There's no secret about that.
Yeah.
All right. Is everybody back?
I'm still here.
Yep.
Okay. Sorry. the audience is probably going to hear some silence in there. I just had a call come in, and it did not, when I clicked OK, why, it put all the rest of you on hold. Not supposed to do that, so thanks again, Skype. And the caller, if you're listening, let's see, I don't know, go to our Facebook page, type your phone number in, and let me try to give you a call back. So whoever called us on the show, go to the Mead House Facebook page, put your number in, and in a message there, and let us try to get you back on the show. So with that, I apologize, guys, but who are we talking to, Jeff? I think, Jeff, we were talking to you about what you had in your cup tonight.
Yeah, we were just finishing up on the Bock. I don't know how much got recorded there, but I was mentioning having my favorite Doppelbock, the Eyinger Celebrator. And to be honest, the Eyinger Brewery in Germany may be one of my favorite breweries ever. They have so many good, solid beers that come out. Generally, the store that I get these from, they tend to run like $3 or $4 a bottle. But it's not hard to justify grabbing one or two every time I go in there and see something new or something that I really love. They have actually a Weizenbock, a wheat-based Bock, that is delicious. And it really makes me want to explore that as an option for a bracket as well.
Perfect. Sounds good. Sorry, guys. I'm sitting here writing down a phone number. Chris. Chris is probably drinking coffee tonight because I know he's got to go back to the hospital, right?
Lipton iced tea.
Lipton iced tea.
Yeah, it's got a beautiful profile of orange pekoe and black tea, just the right amount of tannin and sugar. And I'm having it on the rocks. So
on the rock.
There you go.
And Ryan, poor Ryan, stuck in a hotel room. Did you manage to bring anything with you, or at least hit the liquor store up, or the little gotcha store downstairs, or what's going on there, Ryan? Did we lose Ryan?
Sorry, guys, I'm here. I did have a nice dinner in town, and I had a few glasses of a red Zinfandel called the Predator. And, you know, it's not a science fiction movie from the 80s. It's called the Predator because this is an eco-friendly winery that uses ladybugs to eat the aphids that would damage the grapevines. And it was a nice little bottle. It was very smooth. It had it was drinkable, I think, is what you can say about it. And now I'm drinking a $4 bottle of Fuji water that was in the hotel room here. But to Jeff, Jeff was saying that a Weizenbach, I think is how they say it in German. Would make a nice braggot. I've actually got a Weizenbach going right now, just as a beer down in the fermenting room, and it should be ready by the Super Bowl. And, I also have high hopes. It's a style that I may have only had one or two commercial versions of, but what the hell? If there's a low bar to compare it to, that means the stuff I make, got that low of a standard to meet.
Hey, so Ryan, let me get your opinion on this. Before the show started, Jeff and Aaron and I were talking about box and lagers in general, and the possibility of just brewing something like a bock as an ale. So what, give your thoughts on that. We decided that, especially if we're making it into a braggot, we're sort of breaking the rules anyway. So, what do you think?
I would tend to agree that I think doing it as an ale, or really any lager style as an ale is appropriate. And the reason I say that is, my feeling is that I want the character that the yeast brings out. I think that yeast is an equal ingredient or an equal, contributor to the flavor of what I'm going for here. And I'm not trying to make an American adjunct lager that's devoid of any flavor or taste. I want something that I can enjoy and I feel character and I feel that there's some flavor in. So I like that ale, I like that ale quality to it. Now with that being said, I'll tell you that one style of beer that I have gotten into lately is called the India Pale Lager. And the reason that I've enjoyed a couple of India Pale Lagers is I think it really just isolates the hop if it's done properly. And that I can get into a little bit, on occasion. But overall, Chris, I agree with you guys. I think that doing lager styles as ales is that right on par with what I do. I mean, I've got limited temperature control space, and and if I'm gonna, I've made them before. I've made beers that are recipes as lagers. And I've done them as ales, and I've been pleased with the results. But like you say, you know, you and I have friends that are alcoholics, so they'll drink anything.
Let me
jump in here for a minute. We've actually got a caller on the line. 9773, what's your name? Where are you from? And welcome to the show.
Hi, this is Tony Cormier from El Paso.
How bad did I butcher your name?
Not all that bad, actually. It all depends on what part of the country I'm in when I hear it. My dad's from New England, so that's where the name came from.
Well, welcome to the show, Tony. Tony's the guy that I was talking about earlier. He contacted me just before the show talking about the Kahlua, and you bet. Can't do it tonight, Tony, but damn straight. Let's compare some Kahlua recipes. Really interested in whatever you might want to share with us about a Prohibition-era recipe for a good Kahlua. But did you have a question for any of the guys tonight?
Not really.
Or a comment.
Was listening to you. Yes, I did have a comment. You guys mentioned a few minutes ago about the cranberry melomel, and you were saying something about trying to turn your cranberry recipe into a mead. I've done that with mine. I've done two runs of that so far, still trying to perfect it, but I add orange juice to mine as well, and it makes a nice little zip to it.
Do you just straight up orange juice, or do you use fresh oranges, fresh squeezed oranges, or how do you approach that?
Preferably fresh squeezed, but in a pinch, the Simply Orange will do.
And that's pure. I like that. Chris, this is that same brand of apple juice we use for that graph. That's Simply, like Simply Apples. Yeah. I've seen it all over the store.
Pure juice. They make several different ones, and they're all real good, the ones I've tried.
Well, Tony, how'd you hear about the show?
Actually, I was looking on Facebook for mead groups because I got into it about 2011. I just started doing my own thing. Didn't know there were groups about. And then one day I got a wild hair and said, let's see if there's other people that are into this. And lo and behold, there was. And then I saw you post something about a show. And then, that's where it all started.
Very good. Well, hey, welcome aboard. Glad you're enjoying the show. This show is more about the Mead House. It's kind of an entertaining show. We kind of wander off on different things, but we do have a good time here talking about mead. Hey, you're welcome to stick around if you like. Right now, we need to move into Aaron's segment. I think Aaron's always got something going on in his mind. Now, I've never met this guy, but I can see the wheels turning in Aaron's brain just from our discussions in the past on the show, talking to him in private on a couple of occasions. Aaron, I know you've got a list going, stuff that you want to try, stuff that you might have on a brew list that you're just eager to get into a fermenter. You ready to share that with us tonight?
I am, definitely.
Can I say something before Aaron starts?
Sure.
I think Aaron is dangerous because here's a guy who doesn't talk about a lot of things he's brewing. He doesn't enter competitions. He doesn't put a lot of recipes out there. I'll bet you this guy's making some world-class mead that would blow us all away, and we just don't know about it. I think he's dangerous.
I'm telling you, man, that braggart he sent me was like a goddamn cattle prod. I mean, he got me going in the right direction. So.
He's like that quiet kid that sits in the corner at school that that the bully thinks he can beat up, but then when he jumps on him, he just whoops him all over the playground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you're on to me, Chris. You're on to me. My best kept secret here.
What's on your list, Aaron?
Yeah, absolutely. So a few things on the list for 2017 here. And I think I may just start by prefacing this with kind of a throwback to really what got me into mead and interested in this beverage from the get-go, which I think I've probably shared this story a couple of times now on the show, but it was when the Northern Brewer Homebrew Supply Shop opened here in Milwaukee back in, what was it, 09, 2010 maybe, and Kurt Stock, who's a very well-known mead maker, I think from Minnesota, came to the grand opening and brought several bottles of his mead to share with the customers and kind of give a demo of the mead making procedure. And it just the stuff that he brought just knocked my socks off. It was just incredible. And, you know, I think what I've been kind of striving for with my mead making over the last 7 years is really to try to replicate what he had put together there. And actually, when I've been giving some thought here to what's on the brew list for 2017, I think number one, I found a couple of recipes of his for some melomels that I want to share with the group. But then I have a little bit of a twist on this that I wanted to throw out to the group and get everyone else's thoughts on to see, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? So with that being said, he's got these two melomels. And if you just, you know, go online and Google, you know, Kurt Stock melomels, you'll be able to find these. One is a black currant cherry melomel. And the other is a superberry melomel. And these are both probably more in the style of what Mississippi does over there with just really, really high gravity meads, you know, high alcohol that wrap up with a pretty good amount of sweetness as well. And basically, if you look at both of these, they both incorporate more than 20 pounds of honey. So the black currant one calls for 22 pounds of wildflower honey.
Wow.
And you're going to need it.
You're going to need it, yeah. The approximate original gravity here is 1.161.
That's a Mississippi mead right there.
That's what I was thinking too. When I saw this, I'm like, that's a Mississippi mead if I've ever seen one. So to balance all that sweetness, he's calling for 8 pounds of black currants and 12 pounds of tart cherries to add, and then with that, adding in just 3 gallons of water, which should be enough to bring us to, you know, the 5 gallon mark with the honey and the fruit in there as well. So timely discussion from earlier, listening to Chris and some of his experience with Lalazyme, that may be a good way for me to go here as well. So that's the first recipe that's on the bucket list here, or the brew list for 2017.
Okay. It's a good one. I've made it. In fact, I think I've made every recipe that Kurt has ever posted. And I tell you, someone else who did. JD, do you remember us talking to Texas Dave?
Oh, yeah.
Texas Dave made the multiberry or the superberry, I believe it was.
I remember that. Yep.
And if I'm not mistaken, he sent me a bottle of that, and it was really good. All the stuff I got from him was good, and I believe that multiberry was in there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and that's actually recipe number two
is Kurt's Super Berry Melomel. Similarly, it's just a huge amount of honey, 21 pounds of wildflower, but a triple berry mix. So if you go to the grocery store and walk down the frozen food aisle, you know, these days I always find myself gravitating to the fruit section to see what all types of fruits they have. And you'll find these triple berry mixes of blackberries, raspberries, and blueberries. So you'd pick up 12 pounds of those, 6 pounds of strawberries, and then 96 ounces of a black currant juice. So this recipe would weigh in with a starting gravity of 1.158, so a little bit lower than the other one. But then a target final gravity between 1030 and 1040. So both of these are just going to finish way, way on the sweet side. But when you counterbalance that with the tartness and kind of that sourness that you're going to get from the currants and the tart cherries and, you know, all of the fruit, it's something that's really, really wonderful. I think back to that Midnight Jack that Sergio sent to us. And that was another one that just completely knocked my socks off. One of my favorite meads that I can remember having. So, you know, I think if I can replicate what and come anywhere close to what Kurt had at that day at that Northern Brewer grand opening, I'll be happy. Now, you know, I mentioned that I had a twist to these recipes, and I want to get you guys' thoughts on this. Actually, this dates back to last week. It's an idea that I had. I was drinking a beer on the show last week from Wicked Weed Brewing, and it was that Recurrent, which was an American sour ale fermented with black currants. But what was interesting about it, I was reading the label on here, and it says that they also aged this beer in Cabernet barrels. And there's just something that this beer picked up that made it almost wine-like in quality. And, you know, when you couple that with that black currant flavor, it was just, it's a beer that I'm just really hooked on right now. So it kind of got me thinking then for these Kurt Stock Melomels that he's posted out there. I wanted to get you guys' thoughts. So in the past, I know we've talked about taking like oak cubes and oak chips and soaking that in, you know, bourbon or other liquors. What about soaking it in like a Cabernet or some kind of a wine and then adding that to the mead? What are your thoughts about that? And then if you think it's something that's worth trying, what about adding something like that to one of these Melomels from Kurt?
I don't know why it wouldn't work.
I think soaking the oak cubes in the wine is a good idea for the right mead. But as you said, I've made a lot of those high-gravity Melomels like that. And for my particular taste, I just don't think that oak goes well with something with that much residual sugar. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think it clashes because usually the reason I add oak is to get extra body or mouthfeel. I don't really add it to get oak flavor. And, you know, a mead like that is going to have enough body as it is. I would strongly suggest to you, if you're going to do that and you want to try it, I would go ahead and make a 5-gallon batch. And I would rack 3 gallons of it into a 3-gallon carboy and then use that other 2 gallons to test and see if you like oak in it or not. I would bet that you're going to find that you don't want oak in that at all. And it simply doesn't need it, really. There's so much going on there. You've got so many layers of flavors and so much complexity. It really doesn't need it. At all.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a thing about adding oak too that we've talked about it a couple of times on the show, and this is another subject that we actually need to spend a little more time on, because there is a formula that winemakers use. I mean, you're talking about surface contact area to volume to gallons of wine in a wine barrel. And that's an extremely important thing to know because, and I've even talked to a couple of the local brew shops that sell wine barrels. You've got to be very careful when you're aging anything in wine barrels. And I don't know that you can really fully duplicate the aging of mead or even the homemade wines like I make, the kit wines, using oak cubes or oak chips, because I mean, how do you figure out the surface contact formula? I mean, that's a real science. So, I'm going with Chris, Aaron. I think I would do a 5-gallon batch, take a couple of gallons off and play with it, and see what you come up with.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it because these just the melomels on their own are so good and it's such a rich, flavorful drink. I would hate to do anything to jeopardize a whole 5-gallon batch of that. So I really like that idea of pulling off 3 gallons and saving it, and then maybe for the other ones I try one that's just a plain oaked melomel, and then the other one could be some kind of a Cabernet soaked oaked melomel as well. One other thought that I had about that too is if you do soak your oak cubes in a wine, I would be a little bit cautious to do that in an oaked wine just because if it's a different type of oak or something like that, it might clash, the two oak flavors could clash with one another as well.
There's something about the honey sweetness. I wouldn't really say that the flavors clash, but there's the qualities clash. There's something about a honey sweetness quality and an oak quality that just clash with each other to me.
It's hard to
describe.
Let's throw it back over to Ryan for just a second here. Ryan's working on these piments. What's the intent, Ryan? Are you looking for something sweet? Are you looking for something dry, something oaked? Where are you going with this?
Well, with the white version that I'm calling it a triple white, the white I intend to leave unoaked, and I intend to take pretty dry. My wife and I, our go-to white wine is a dry Riesling, which it's not uncommon, but most people think Rieslings are sweet. And this is, the dry Rieslings are what we enjoy. And so this is the white I'm going to take pretty dry. I'm going to let it age a little while. I hope some of the honey comes back in it and that it gives maybe a little of a perceived sweetness, even if it's not a gravity sweetness.
What about the going more along the lines with what Aaron's trying to do here? What about the red? What are you your Zinfandel?
So jumping over to the red, this is where I am going to oak this one. I've got a Tuscan blend. It was called, again, at Midwest Supplies. It's, I guess supposed to mimic a Tuscan type barrel. And I am gonna drop those in and oak this one. I don't want the oak to be a dominant force in what you're getting, but I do want, I do think that it's going to help round out the flavors quite a bit.
Sweet. I mean, you're going for.
This one's going to be fairly dry as well. It's going to be along the same lines of what you would get if you were drinking a bottle of red Zinfandel or a bottle of.
That's kind of opposite of what Aaron's trying to do here because he's doing something. He's working with something with some incredible amount of sweetness. I mean,
right.
22 pounds of wildflower honey. That's going to be a sweet mead.
1161 starting gravity. Yeah,
yeah,
that's up there.
But you'll be surprised with 8 pounds of black currants and then all the other fruit that's basically all of it is tart except for maybe the blueberry part, and very acidic, especially like the tart cherries. You got raspberries. There's a reason why that 40-year-old mead was a raspberry, very high acidity, ages really well.
I think, you know, something that just, I don't mean to interrupt, something that just flashed into my mind, and if I don't say it, I'll forget it. Think along the lines of a port wine. Okay, because port wines are aged in barrels for sometimes years and years and years, and I've got a couple of bottles here. Just I've got one that's almost 100-year-old port. So what if you thought along those lines? Because you're working, some of these ports are fairly sweet. I mean, they're a dessert wine, an after dinner wine. I mean, it's not like you pour a whole glass of port like you would a glass of Cabernet and eat it with a steak dinner. So what if you thought along the lines of a sweet port, barrel aged port, Aaron?
Yeah, I like where you're going there. Port is definitely a beverage that I enjoy. My wife really enjoys as well, and I've had a hard time finding the right mead for her. So that something along those lines might be the right way to go. I'm just trying to think how to replicate kind of a port style mead then.
I don't know, Jeff.
Because you've got other things going on there. You've got oxidation happening and lots of things.
Jeff, go ahead.
You know, I've given some thought to doing a port style mead as well. And of course, the major barrier to this is the fact that it is technically illegal for us to distill spirits in this country, so you really can't get the fortified spirit edition from a distilled mead like you would with a port wine.
You can go buy it in the bottle, right? I mean, you can go buy a bottle of cognac or,
You could use cognac. You could use sherry or another distilled brandy or what have you. You really couldn't get a distilled mead the same way you would distill a similar wine to the one you're adding the distillate to. But you could take that approach. Yeah, absolutely. And there are other things you could do to it as far as adding adjuncts on oak and things like that. It would actually probably be a really tasty beverage.
I like the sherry idea.
The sherry would definitely give it a little something different, and realistically, it would also, it might, just because it is naturally oxidized in a way that is palatable to a lot of people, if you're into that kind of a thing, it could help mask some oxidization as the meat ages too, realistically.
What kind of sherry would you be using?
Good question. A good one.
To be perfectly honest, I am not up on my sherries. I've had one or two. I found them okay, but it's not the kind of thing I seek out.
Here's the thing, okay? And I've applied, I don't buy cheap whiskey. I don't buy cheap tequila. When I want to drink something good, I buy the good stuff, okay? The bottles of whiskey and tequilas that I buy are over $40 a bottle. And I've spent as much as $120 on a bottle of tequila. It's garbage in, garbage out. So if you go get the cheap crap, don't be surprised if it's going to taste like crap. So I would shop around and get familiar. Now I'll have to email it to you. I can't think of the guy's name. There's a guy on YouTube that he's a certified, licensed taste tester. And he does whiskeys, tequilas, I mean, just any kind of liquor you can think of. And he's got a pretty good YouTube following. So I'll get that information and send it to you. But I like this direction, Aaron. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think it definitely sounds like an interesting direction to go. And, you know, I know one of the things that we like to discuss and just an interesting topic is that of experimentation. And I think, you know, this is just an area where it's there are tons of experiment ideas that are kind of going through my mind right now in terms of, you know, adding different types of wine, port, sherry types of flavors to melomels and even piments too. I mean, that wasn't one that I was thinking about sharing during the show as a, you know, on the brew list for this year, but piments is another area that definitely intrigues me as well.
Yeah.
Aaron, let me just say, I'm sure if you've looked into Kurt Stock's recipes, you've probably come across the Strawbanna Cabana.
Ooh, I don't know that I have, actually.
Strawbanna Cabana.
Well, love the name, though.
Well, you might want to put that way down on the bottom of the list.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems like when I find someone who makes a style of mead that I like, they always have one recipe that just, I don't know, something's wrong. I made that recipe and it's just wrong. I mean, even the alcoholics don't really care for it. But he won some contest with it. So maybe I did something really bad wrong. I thought I followed the directions, but all of his berry melomels are great. That Strawbanna Cabana is just weird.
Okay.
Really weird.
I'll steer clear of that one then.
Well, Aaron, it sounds like you got, and I don't know, you know, we only talked about a couple of them. I know you got more than that, but I tell you that black currant cherry deal that you got going here, I mean, I could see several renditions of that one. I like the idea of a port style mead using those ingredients. I mean, that would be an awesome, and I can see several, of your fermenters full of that. With your, you know, maybe it's a cognac in one, maybe it's a, adding some. Oh yeah, baby! I like where you're going.
I'm getting thirsty just thinking about it, man.
Our guest Tony, you've been hanging out here all night with us here for at least for the last half hour, 45 minutes. Tony, brewing since or making mead since 2011. Is there anything that you got on your list for 2017 that you haven't done yet?
Well, that I haven't done yet. I was thinking a sizer with sage to go good with pork dishes. That one's been on my crew list for forever and a day. I just haven't gotten around to getting to that one. I've been wanting to try out a pina colada type mead. Before my brainwave leaves me, you guys were talking about the oak and other stuff right now. What about soaking your oak on your Kahlua and adding that to your coffee ML?
What
would that do?
What about soaking your oak in Kahlua and adding that to like a port or a stout or a porter? Holy cow, dude. You just, oh man, I got to write this down. I've been, go ahead.
Another to brew list is, I've been wanting to make an Acerglen for a while now.
What's an Acerglen now?
That's made with maple syrup.
Maple syrup, that's right. Okay.
I've got a semi-Acerglin going. That banana bread that I was telling you about,
yeah,
it's got a quart of maple syrup in it, along with the honey and everything else.
Now, the one thing that I've always heard about maple syrup, and I got this over from doing the old show, was that it's very hard to get the maple flavor because syrup is like that's like, you know, when you put it in the fermenter, that's like the first thing the yeast goes after. You know, and it ferments all the way out. So, how confident are you that this maple syrup is going to contribute to a flavor?
I'm thinking about putting it in secondary.
Okay.
But that's just preliminary thoughts right now. I'm nowhere near ready to start anything new. I have to go out and get some more local mesquite honey.
Did you, Chris, did you add the maple up front, or are you waiting until?
Well, what I did was I held out the maple until most of the fermentation had died down. And once it started getting down pretty low, then I added in the maple so that it still fermented, and I'm sure it fermented out, but it wasn't there during the most vigorous fermentation. So hopefully that held in more of the flavor and aromatics.
Yeah.
So more of a late addition.
Yeah, just a late addition. I think I added it about maybe 50% of the way, maybe a little over 50% through the fermentation. And then I went ahead and added it in. And really didn't even bother trying to stir it that much or dissolve it. I just basically poured it in, gave it a light stir, and I put it in. I don't have my logbook in front of me, but I actually think I put it in along with my final degassing, which would have been right around day 7.
Okay.
So when I did that final degassing, I went ahead and stirred that in, and I don't even think it got dissolved, but the yeast will find it. They'll get it.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, guys, to wrap the show up, I've got this, I was toying around with this, you know, at the beginning of the show, we were talking, and Chris asked something about doing a lagers and ale. I found this, it's a beer recipe, basically. It's a lager. I mean, it uses this is liquid malt extract, but the Pilsen style liquid malt extract. And then this stuff called, I don't know what this is, soft candy sugar blonde. I have no idea what that is.
Really, it's a Belgian sugar. It's caramelized sugar. They try to call it fancy stuff. It's caramelized sugar.
So how does that contribute to any kind of flavor? Or
it contributes sugar that turns into alcohol really easily. The Belgians use it to boost up the alcohol by volume.
Okay, so the darker the color,
and you'll get a little more flavor.
That's true.
The lighter stuff is very, very neutral, and the darker stuff can contribute a little bit of body to it. And as Jeff was saying, that's typical in certain Belgian styles.
So
remember when
we
talked about the Belgian quads?
That's right.
Where most of that dark color comes from is from that candy sugar.
Okay, so if I took, say, a half pound or a pound of dark brown sugar and just put it in my little frying pan deal and just caramelized it, I'm going to accomplish the same thing, right? You think?
You know, if you were using candy making methods, you know, and there are some,
yeah,
you know, things that you want to do to make sure the temperature is right and the
yeah,
sugar's taken care of, then yep, basically yes.
Okay. All right. Well, it kind of goes, you know, and that may be, I mean, I might even be able to cross that off the list because, of course, the next thing, this is why I went, you know, I did that crock pot thing this afternoon. But this is, I'm calling this Minnesota Blonde Braggot because this is a beer that's typically brewed in Minnesota as a lager. And I'm turning it into a Braggot. So, you know, it's got a little over 6 pounds of the Pilsner. I'm going to add 3 pounds of honey to it, wildflower honey. But I'm thinking now that I may lightly caramelize the honey. I don't want a real dark. I don't want the roasted marshmallow. I want it just before it gets to roasted marshmallow. And it's got this Herzbrucker hops in it. But anyway, so that's a recipe that I'm working on for my next Braggot project. Of course, I still have the cream orange deal going in the fermenter. It's in the last stages of fermentation right now. So
let me ask you, I just had another brain flash. Something you just said triggered this. You know, I was talking about possibly doing a Braggot with a Belgian quad. And the Belgian quad recipe calls for the D180 Belgian candy syrup, which is the darkest of all of them. What if you did that with honey?
Yeah.
Maybe just really caramelize it until it's just, I mean, absolutely black. Substitute that out. You think that would work?
I've seen a video on YouTube where he does that. I'll have to find that. But, yeah, he did it until black smoke came out of the bubbles and made a – I mean, I didn't do that to my my bullshit. I did mine in a crock pot for 9 hours on low and then 1 hour on high. And it's tasting great right now.
9 hours? Holy crap.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I set it in there, and then I went to work, and then I came home, turned it on high for an hour, and turned it off, and put everything in my fermentation bucket.
Yeah. And, JD, wow. When I told you 3 to 4 hours on high earlier to get, you know, the level I'm looking for, I'm looking for molasses black. I'm looking for dark. So that'll get you there.
Okay. Well, I need to play around with the crock pot thing anyway. I did it. I've got some molasses in a couple of quart jars here that I did in the pressure cooker. That's dangerous because you have no idea what's happening to your honey. And this is only after, I think it was a 30 minute cook. I did it a couple of times. The first time I did it was something around something along the lines of a 90 minute pressure cooker. And you talk about, I can roof a house with this stuff, dude. okay. I mean, it's, I don't know what the hell to use it in yet, but I'm going to use it. So I'm thinking something a little bit lighter than that, but just before, you know, because there was a stage, I did it a couple times. There's a stage you get to just before it gets campfire marshmallow. Now, I like that flavor, okay, but I want to stop it before it gets there. I want the roasted marshmallow. I don't want the campfire taste, okay? Sure. So that's what I'm trying to avoid, and that's why I went out and got the crock pot. I don't think I can do that in a pressure cooker. I'd go through my 5 gallon bucket of honey in no time, trying to get to the right place. So that's why I got the crock pot. So,
and just as a heads up, I've mentioned it before on the show. I don't know if I've mentioned it recently, but when you're toasting the honey in the crock pot, you do have to keep an eye on it because the level of coloration goes exponentially. You know, you get one shade after 2 hours, the next shade comes an hour later, and then within the last 10-15 minutes, it goes from kind of a vague orange to a really dark brown. I mean, the last stages of that coloration happen really fast.
Yeah.
It bears keeping an eye on.
Did I lose Ryan?
No, I'm here.
Okay. I thought that might have been me, Ryan. I'm sorry. Yeah, I just, you know, I was going to do it today, and then the show was coming up. I had to get my wife up, get her off to work and everything. And I thought, you know what? I need a day where I'm not doing anything. I need to concentrate on doing this honey thing in the crock pot. So maybe this coming weekend or something, I'll give it a shot. But at any rate, guys, I think we've wasted enough time on tonight's show. There's so many things going on. Aaron, I am super excited, dude. You know, my braggart thing is your fault. Now I'm thinking, now I got this port thing going on in my brain. And I'm thinking, I'm thinking something with that blackcurrant cherry melmel deal, with all that fruit and that high gravity, all that sweetness, and adding, you know, maybe 8 ounces of a nice, good, rich sherry to it. I don't know that I'd even bother with the oak at that point. But if you do, I don't know that I would even soak the oak in anything. I would probably just put the oak in just for a short amount of time and see what happens. But, mm-hmm. I mean, dude, the wheels are turning.
Yeah, so I blame Aaron and Jeff for the braggart thing. Now Tony's come along and got me thinking about doing something with Kahlua. As of right now, Ryan is still the only one in good standing. So don't come along with any more ideas, Ryan.
No. Do my best.
And hey, Tony, thanks for calling the show, dude. If you want to hang out, we usually have about a 10 or 15 minute little pre or post show hangout here. But with that, we're gonna wrap things up. Mississippi, gosh, it was nice to have you hanging out with us tonight too. Glad you didn't have to go back to work, or maybe you still do.
I do, just not when I thought.
All right. Hey, you know what? Why don't we get back together next week, about 9 o'clock, what do you think, Tuesday night? And we'll do this all over again. So we'll see you at the Mead House next Tuesday.